On last Monday night, ABC TV had a rare ratings coup when the Q&A program featured what the ABC billed as the great debate. On one side, you had Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion and one of the most famous exponents of radical atheism. And then on the other, you had HEGCP, His Eminence George Cardinal Pell, who is, of course, a believer. Supposedly, it was a debate, but really, there was little chance of movement from either side. Aristotle said that he believed in the unmoved mover, this first principle. Well, in lots of ways, both His Eminence and Mr. Dawkins represented this other principle, this sense of the unmoved. We're not quite sure what, but this principle that wasn't really open to any kind of discussion, dialogue. There was no sense of movement. There was no sense of real engagement. Mr. Dawkins presented this hypothesis that unbelief, or this possibility of unbelief, was quite a new phenomenon, something that had only happened in modern times. When, in fact, if you look through the history of Christianity and our most sacred texts, such as the Gospel of John, you have this deep exploration about people who are struggling to believe. From the very opening lines of John's Gospel, John is wanting us to know what it is that Jesus is about. When he opens with his prologue, he declares so powerfully, so simply, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So from the very first verse, John is very clear about what he believes, that Jesus, the Son of God, was with God in the beginning, and indeed that he was God himself. But as he continues along in this story of the mighty works of Jesus, of the powerful signs that Jesus worked, and the first half of the gospel is built around these seven signs that are meant to lead people into this experience of faith, to lead them from doubt, from questioning, into this encounter with Christ, into this possibility of a true belief about who Jesus really is. Tonight in our gospel, we conclude the Gospel of John. Scholars tell us, and it's kind of clear in that final line, that this was the original ending of the Gospel of John. This is him going full circle, bringing us back to this position of someone who's doubting, someone who's struggling, and then finally he's brought into belief. If we look through the Gospel, we'll see, for example, Nicodemus, who comes to Jesus at night because he's afraid of the other Jewish leaders. He doesn't want to be seen to being associated with Jesus, who struggles to understand the kinds of things that Jesus talks about, but who at the end of the gospel also comes to this position of faith. In chapter 4, we have the woman at the well. At the beginning of the encounter, the woman is a Samaritan. She's an outsider completely. And yet, through this simple discussion that she enters into with Jesus, he leads her into this declaration of faith, where at the end of chapter 4, she makes this declaration: can he be the Messiah? Can he be the one that not even our people, the Samaritans, but the Jewish people are looking for, longing for, hoping for? Another example is in the story of the man born blind in the 9th chapter of John's Gospel. There we have this person who, at the beginning, again, he doesn't even really know who Jesus is. There's this series of discussions and dialogues as the man is slowly led to say, yeah, maybe he's a prophet. He's certainly a good man. He's certainly doing some great deeds. And at the end of chapter 9, this man suddenly falls at the feet of Jesus in worship and surrender. These stories are meant to call us into that similar place. If we're like Thomas, if we're really struggling to understand where Jesus fits into our life, how this incredible event of the resurrection could possibly be true, how could it be that someone who is so dead just a week before and now is able to be there in their very midst, in their very presence, even though the doors are closed and locked. How is it that this man is able to suddenly be there in their very midst? How is it that someone who had been betrayed, someone who had been denied, that they had all run away, and yet the first thing that he does is to give them that classic Jewish greeting, Shalom Aleichem, to peace be with you, to offer that peace, to share that gift with them. Even though they're scared out of their minds, he's wanting to share that peace. So three times tonight in our gospel, Jesus say to the disciples, as he pours out this peace upon them, to share this gift with them, to open them up to that possibility. And then, as in always, in each of the resurrection, the Easter appearances, in all four gospels, Jesus isn't content just to forgive. He's not content just to appear, but he also commissions. So as the Father sent me, so I send you. Go and forgive sins. Those whose sins you forgive, they are forgiven. Those whose sins you retain, they are retained. Such power is given to the early church, is given to these disciples to go and to do the same, a ministry that we continue to do and exercise through the sacrament of mercy, the sacrament of reconciliation. Thomas is not there. Thomas, called Didymus the twin, is not there as part of this group. But you'll notice that 8 days later, on the same Sunday, the first day of the week, the first day, always a pointer, a reminder that this is about new creation. This is about the new life and the energy of Jesus beginning to do his work in his church and in his community. So he then appears to Thomas. There's no rebuke. There's no saying to Thomas, you know, you silly idiot. Why didn't you believe? Why weren't you able to believe on the testimony of the women and of the other apostles? He simply invites Thomas to believe. He invites Thomas to use the best of his science, to use the physics, to use the touch, to do everything in his power to open to Thomas this path to faith, to belief, to life. And of course, this extraordinary thing happens. That Thomas, alone among all of the characters in the gospel, is able to come from absolute, it seems, disbelief into this profound sense of belief, where he falls again at the feet of Jesus and makes that strongest of all declarations when he calls out to Jesus, "My Lord and my God." No one else comes to that declaration. No one else is able to make that profound and moving declaration. Remembering in the Jewish context, it was absolutely forbidden, impossible to believe that any human being could be God. God alone was the Lord of the Old Testament, Lord of the Covenant, the Lord who had revealed himself in so many signs and wonders and so many miraculous deeds, but God who was alone, God who was absolute. And yet here, Thomas Lee is led to this true belief, is led to this declaration as he worships Jesus. And then in this conclusion that John then presents to us, many other signs were done. Many other things happened. But these are recorded. That we, the readers of this gospel, we even separated by so many centuries from these events, might be led to truly believe who Jesus is. Disbelief, doubt, confusion, they're not problems in the wisdom and the wonder and the beauty of God. God is not afraid of our doubts. God is not afraid of our questions. All of these things are good. All of these things have their purpose. The church is not afraid of us asking questions. The church is not afraid of us to have these questions, to have these doubts. But the Lord wants us to ask them with an honesty. The Lord wants us to deal with them, to tackle them, and at every stage to keep our eyes firmly on the risen Lord, to allow his gaze to invite us into this experience of life and love, to allow ourselves to journey with him on this first day, this new day, this day of the Lord's creation, this day when everything that is about resurrection begins to be lived in our world. That's what this season of Easter is about, this celebration of our life, this possibility and opportunity to really worship the Lord, to surrender our doubts, to open our hearts to that relationship, just as Thomas did.